Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Peter says that today's program is very meaty.
And you'll understand why as we go through, but we're going to unveil the program one track at a time, just to maintain your level of interest and fascination. But first up, we have an old story that's really a new story that's an old story. How an Italian coming to the United States decided it was important that he create the salumi, or charcuterie, if you like to call it that, of his native land, and made a wonderful success out of it, and it's a wonderfully tasty product too. Right, sweetheart?
Always.
Always salumi.
Well, we're talking to Jennifer Johnson from Hawaii, but actually she's a marketing director for a company that has nothing whatsoever to do with Hawaii, Ollie's Salumeria. Jennifer, welcome on the menu.
Thank you.
Yeah, you sent us some really interesting samples to try, including the cute little, what were they called?
The Salamini.
The Salamini, which was a finalist for a Sophie Award this year.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah, we just introduced the Salamini. It's new here in the States. They're bite-sized morsels of salami, totally edible. It's something that you would find in Italy quite often, just walking on the streets. You can buy them off a street vendor. But it was really nice being able to introduce that into the market here in the U.S.
Now, a curious thing, we've been in Italy literally dozens of times.
Many hundreds. And
I've never seen that baby salumi before.
Really?
Yeah, and its shelf life in the refrigerator was approximately 2 days.
typically you wouldn't put them in the fridge.
Well, we actually didn't. We ate them before any need for refrigeration. They were so delicious.
So tell us
the story. We don't need the complicated story of why you're in Hawaii, because you're really sort of working and playing there at the same time, and the river connection, because your salumis are sold there. But how did this business get off the ground?
Well, years ago, back in 2010, the founder of our company, Oliviero Colmignoni, was talking with another one of his friends, Chip Bosnick, we call him Ali for short. He's born and raised in Italy, and he was over here in the States. And his good friend Chip Bosnick asked him, why can't we get the good cured meats and salumi here in the States that we can find in Italy? You know, it's frustrating. And Ali said, well, you know, the big reason is the pig, the quality of the pig. So if you can get me quality pig, I'll make you whatever products you want. So long story short, Chip procured some of the best heritage breed Berkshire pork that he could find, the best pigs, gave it to Ali, and Ali made some prosciutto a couple years in the making, but, you know, they started that way and started selling product in 2011, prosciutto and salami and all of that good stuff. And by 2012, we were nationwide with Whole Foods. So it's a long story, but it took a very short amount of time. We found that if you can start with the best quality ingredients, having the best quality pigs that you can find, it gives a very beautiful flavor salumi product.
Was Ollie a charcuterie in Italy, or did he just sort of genuinely?
He comes from a long line of salumi makers. He is actually fourth generation. So this is something he was born to do.
But he wasn't doing it in the United States before.
He was helping out. His family owned Fiorucci Foods. So he was, you know, working with them. But it was something, he always wanted to do something on his own. And so that is where Ali Salumeria came from.
So it's headquartered in Virginia?
Correct. Yes, Mechanicsville, Virginia, which is right outside of Richmond. And now that our company has grown so much, we are opening a second facility in Oceanside, California.
See, now that sounds to me more like the kind of environment a salumi maker would want, with the ocean breezes and so forth.
Yeah, it allows us to be bi-coastal, so we can better supply our customers, and it also allows us the opportunity to build a facility from scratch, which is great. We've learned a lot over the past few years, and now we can really build a facility tailored to our needs.
Now, you also have a product source. You have a pig source in California, too?
Most of our pigs come from two different sources. Now, that's not to say that we only use those two. We use a handful. But most of our pigs come from a place called Becker Lane Farms in Iowa. A guy out there by the name of Jude Becker does a great job with his Berkshire pigs. He's one of the only that makes organic Berkshire pigs here in the U.S. And then we also source from Dubertone, and that is in Canada. So those are our two big pig sources.
Well, now, the title of your company includes the word Americana. Does that mean that the traditional flavorings and recipes are altered at all for the American palate?
We don't. We offer a very traditional Italian product. We don't cut corners. We use the same methods that were developed years and years, you know, a long time ago. We say Americana just so they understand that it's a product that's made here in America. Most people will taste our product, even, for example, at the fancy food show that I just came back from. People come over, they taste our product, and by the taste, they assume it's from Italy because they're getting a real, authentic taste and flavor. So they assume that it's from Italy. So we have the Americana on the name to remind people that no, we're an American company.
Now, I think one of the samples you sent us was chorizo. Which is a Spanish sausage.
It is. It is Spanish. The chorizo is one of my children's favorite, actually. It's made with real Spanish pimentón de la Vera. So we use the best ingredients out there, the most authentic ingredients. The chorizo was just kind of fun for us to do something that had a Spanish flavor to it, and it's one of the more popular ones now.
Now, I'm sure you must have plans to expand the product line, but tell us, first of all, what's available today.
Sure. We have an all-natural salami line, and the all-natural line is made with antibiotic-free pork. The pigs were never administered antibiotics or growth promotants. They were fed an all-vegetarian diet, nitrite-free, and that comes in 10 different varieties. I could list them if you want.
Sure, fire away.
Sure, yeah. So we've got the chorizo, which you mentioned. We now have a new hot chorizo, which is made with a spicy paprika. We have calabrese, norcino, Napoli, Toscano, wild boar, pepperoni, molisana, and I think I need to name one more. Yeah, exactly. That's where I get stuck all the time. So we have 10 and I might have named all 10. Who knows? We also have the organic line, and that's made with certified USDA organic pork. We were the first ones in the U.S. to introduce a full salami stick of organic meat on the market, and that comes in three of our more popular flavors. It comes in the hot chorizo, the molisana, and the calabrese.
Now, you mentioned earlier in our conversation, you mentioned that the first thing that happened was that Ollie actually made prosciutto.
Yes,
are you doing that too, or are you focusing on charcuterie?
Good question. So we did that heavily in the beginning, and we've started to, it takes up so much space is the issue with prosciutto, so much space and time. So when we introduced to the American market, we realized, wow, the salami business is crazy here. It's going nuts. So that became the majority of our business within the space that we had. So now, like I said, we're growing with Oceanside, California facility, and when that opens, we'll, you know, who knows what we'll start to do, but we'll maybe start to do more prosciutto. We're definitely going to get into doing some sliced products, which we would love to do, making it easier for the U.S. consumer to have these products at home, you know, being able to go to the shelf and just pick up exactly what they need that's already been sliced and prepared for them.
Now, how widely are you in distribution? You're in Whole Foods, but are you in Whole Foods nationwide or just regionally?
Yes. Yeah, we have been Whole Foods nationwide since 2012. That process went really fast for us. And we are, you know, we're in So Kroger's, we're in Costco and select markets. We're in Safeways. So we're really kind of anywhere you can find it. You know, like you said, we're here in Hawaii. This past month, we first exported to Canada. So this is our first kind of entry into the Canadian market.
Now, do you do both wholesale and retail?
We don't sell direct. We do wholesale, but we do have a small business of, you know, online sales for customers. So it's nothing that's trying to make that the majority of our business by any means.
Well, somebody can get a hold of it by going online. What is the website?
Olli.com. OLLI.com.
Okay.
Well, that's a small little shop section. That's a great catch to be able to get Olli.com as an internet name. Boy, that's good.
Yes, that was not easy either.
I'm sure it wasn't. You want to know why our program's called OnTheMenuRadio.com? Because the cyber squatter owns OnTheMenu.com.
Right. Oh, really?
And he wanted an outrageous sum of money to sell it to us. So we said, we'll come up with a different name. So Olli.com is a real win. It sounds like a really winning story. And we thank you so much for sharing it with us. Now, we know you're working some of the time in Hawaii, but make sure you have a good time with your relatives there. And we are, of course, jealous that you're there with some Olli salumi and some sunshine. And we wish we had both here.
Thank you. It's going to be wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Anne. You guys take care.
And after the break, we'll be butchering in Brooklyn.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I'm really happy to have Tom Mylan on the program to interview him about his new book called The Meat Hook Meat Book, which is natural, isn't it? Your butcher shop is called The Meat Hook Butcher Shop, and the subtitle here is Buy, Butcher, and Cook Your Way to Better Meat. And I'll tell you, I admit it to you, I did not read every word of this book because it's so packed with information. It was an impossibility and a few sittings. But I will read every word of it because it has so much information. I'm going to keep it.
Well, I was going to say I was alarmed when I finished the final edit of the book, and it was over 80,000 words. I didn't think I had that many words in it, so it's kind of a lot to read.
Did they have you cut it?
Not really, no.
Oh, that's good, because cutting is the hardest thing about writing, I think.
Yeah, we ended up cutting some photographs and putting in some illustrations instead to sort of jam everything in there with a shoehorn.
I thought the most interesting thing that Anne told me about the book, and I've read less of it than she did, is that you became a carnivore. You started off as something else, that V word?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was a vegetarian for about 3 or 4 years before I moved to New York.
A bratty 14-year-old.
You were a bratty 14-year-old at the time. Okay. So what happened? You had an epiphany or what?
It was right around the time of the Mad Cow. So I was 26. I was old enough to know better. But I didn't stop eating meat because of, like, really, like, health concerns or because, you know, I thought that, like, animals were cute and furry. It wasn't anything like really. Like, it was more about the ethics. I just didn't want to participate, give money into a system that was engineered to basically mistreat animals for their short, awful existence so that I could be fed cheap, antibiotic and hormone-packed meat. So I just quit for about 3.5 years. And then I moved to New York and I started becoming part of the local food scene. The only job, I didn't move to New York to become a butcher. I moved to New York to become like a great painter or, you know, write the great American novel or something. I went to art school and like that kind of stuff. But I had been doing, you know, I'd been a wine buyer and cheese buyer for Whole Foods Market and worked in food pretty much my whole life. And the first job I could get when I moved here was working for Dean DeLuca and then that for Maria's Cheese, and that got me into the whole like local food food system, and I was right when the farmers markets were really, like, exploding in New York, and got my first paycheck from Murray's, which is the first place that actually, like, paid me with the band, and went directly to the farmers market to buy, like, a $16 pork chop, and then I ate it, and it was like I'd never eaten pork before in my life. It was just, I don't know. It was a revelation. From then on, I was really, I was back in the saddle. Started eating meat, good.
Yeah, no, of course, my background was similar to yours with this art and writing thing, and I still would like to do the great American novel.
I missed the part of your life where you were a butcher.
Yeah, you're not likely to see that one.
I must have been sleeping during that part.
And one of your partners is a Pittsburgh neighbor.
That's correct. I have two partners. Ben Turley, he's from West Virginia originally, and then my partner Brett Young is a proud product of Pittsburgh through and through. Yeah, there's actually a picture of him with one of his recipes that's in the book for City Chicken, and he's wearing a pirate's hat and has a terrible towel over his shoulder.
Oh, was that? I knew there was something familiar about that City Chicken picture.
Yeah.
I didn't realize what it was.
I was trying to explain. Not just now with the book. Many times I've tried to explain City Chicken to Peter, but it was a concept that I couldn't get across.
It didn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense when you think of it in the context of today, when the cheapest meat you can buy at the butcher is chicken.
Sure, yeah.
So this is what makes it confusing.
Right, I never liked it anyhow.
It's about as sensible as chicken fried steak, which I never did
that.
Understand the appetite
yeah.
for that.
The thing is that I think they're both pretty delicious. Like, anytime you can deep fry something, it's making it better usually.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you're a fan of
Turducken.
Chicken fried steak too.
Chicken fried steak, yeah, I love chicken fried steak. I like it a little bit better than I like City Chicken, but I feel like fried food's like pizza, even when it's not. Not the best. It's still pretty good.
Well, I don't know. City Chicken, I mean, you can tell it's a cheat just by tasting it.
It's really funny, Tom. I'll just digress for just a second longer. We just got back from New Orleans. We interviewed the chef owner of a restaurant called Pizza Domenica. He said, it's really funny. I'm a chef, so it was hard for me to fulfill my promise that I would only have a pizza oven. I wouldn't have a deep fryer. He said somehow it feels like not being a chef, not having a deep fryer, but he decided nevertheless that was the way it was going to go.
Yeah.
I'm not shy. He's a really good guy. Anyhow, back to this book. I mean, you're very organized in this book. When I say there's a lot of information, I don't mean to imply that it's not organized, because it is. Why don't you lay out the general overall organization, how you built around animals and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, I think no small part of, like, it being so organized is I actually, when I wrote it, I used a relatively new writing software called Scrivener that allows you to compartmentalize everything and move it around. And you're not just working with, like, one long document so you can't see the sort of larger picture. So that definitely helped me organize it a lot. But, yeah, I mean, the way that it's organized, there's the introduction and that sort of, like, lays out both who we are and why we wrote this book, and also, you know, what we stand for as far as, like, the mission of both this book and of our business to promote not just the consumption of meat or learning about butchery, but actually the consumption and learning about butchery in the context of good meat, that is, like, pasture-raised meat from small family farms that are slaughtered at small family slaughterhouses that are then sold to you. Real animals raised by real people being sold to you by real people, telling you recipes that real people want to make.
Yeah, well, you said this is actually, or no, Bon Appetit is where I read it, said this is the first butchering book that the home cook can actually use.
Yeah, which was very kind of them. But, I mean, it's really structured around the average person. It's not like one of those books that if you're not some sort of wannabe line cook or it's an introduction to advanced techniques, perhaps in some of them, but it's done in a very, like, easy to understand, conversational kind of way. It's the same way that I would explain some sort of cooking technique across the butcher counter to one of our customers. But, and then we go basically animal by animal, starting with the largest animal, beef, and then going from there, and you know, talking a little bit about like, you know, animal husbandry and these kind of things and what beef means to us as like a nation, and then just going section by section and sort of talking a little bit about the different cuts that come out of those subprimals and primals of the animal. And then we have recipes in each one of those sections that utilize cuts from that animal, so you can get an idea of what kind of preparations you can do. It start with beef, and we go all the way to rabbits, and then we end up with at the very end with fat and bones. So what do you do with the fat? What do you do with the bones? And then a little section about like just cooking meat, sort of in general, like more of a little bit more abstract, something that's not just encapsulated within the recipes. But the whole point of every recipe and every section is to sort of sneakily give the person reading the book and making the recipes a good working knowledge of what to do with that particular cut. And by the idea was that by the time you reach the end of the book, you would have a good working knowledge of, like, you know, every single animal and almost every single part, and like what ways are best to prepare each one of those parts. So it's kind of like stealthily trying to inoculate my readers with like most of the information that I've gleaned over the years of working as a butcher in restaurants and then in the butcher shop.
It's interesting. I can remember several years ago we were at a pub restaurant in London, and we were having lunch in the kitchen with the chef preparing things for us, and our mealtime stretched and stretched and stretched, and we started to get kind of jealous looks from some of the people who were in the kitchen. So the chef at one point said, you know what, we're going to have to finish up pretty soon because the guys need the table because they have a pig and a sheep to butcher, and they're going to do it on the same table. Now, that's a long way around asking the question, did you expect people would actually want to do this themselves, that they would essentially take a portion of their kitchen table and start chopping away, or did you expect that they might take your book and with the knowledge they have and practice the book themselves, go see their local butcher and say, and point to the page and say, I want that piece?
I really tried to include enough. So there's a section at the beginning of the pork chapter, which is basically pig to pork in 5 cuts. And so that's, you know, because that's a very, so there is information in there as far as like, that will enable the average person, if they decide to go bananas and actually butcher, you know, like a large portion of meat. That's definitely in there, but that wasn't really the focus, because I don't think I didn't think at the time when I was writing it that it was really realistic that the average person would butcher something much larger than a chicken or a rabbit or something like that, just merely because it's just sort of impractical.
It's physically challenging.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that hard to do. I mean, that's the kind of the, I mean, like butchering, like the cutting up of animals isn't the hard part of butchering. The hard part of butchering is actually like learning like what every part is good for and how to maximize your yield, so not throwing anything away, and how to make every single part of the animal into something that is not just palatable but actually good. So we actually spend most of our time in the butcher shop not cutting up animals. We spend most of the time trying to deal with, like, for instance, pig heads. You know, like pig heads are problematic. And we would never sell them. No one would ever buy them.
Why?
So we need to, because in New York City, most people, like, they just don't have, like, the refrigeration space. They don't have enough room. It's, you know, it's also kind of gross to a lot of people.
Peter always tells the story. When we were in Australia, my neighbors said, you've got to roast a pig's head. So I went off to the butcher shop, and I asked for a pig's head. And the butcher put the pig's head on the counter, which was exactly at eye level with me.
Uh-huh.
It's looking at me, and it has one blue eye and one brown eye, and that did it. I couldn't go near it.
Yeah.
That was too personalized.
So we never did have the roast pig's head. We've had grouper heads. We've had a wide variety of interesting substances, but that was the end of the line.
Well, no, we had the whole, well, we had half pig's head, the Fergus Henderson cooked.
Yeah, but we didn't cook
Melbourne.
We didn't cook it.
But,
yeah.
But this, your diagrams, did we talk about the, this,
this wonderful idea where you have all these cuts of beef photographed against a galaxy?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, because when I was planning this book out, I was like, well, do I really want to, like, do a step-by-step, this is how you break everything down? And, I there were already butchering books out at that point that did have that information. I didn't want to not have some sort of information as far as, like, how animals come apart and, you know, what that looks like. And I was remembering back to when I was sort of a budding hot rodder in Southern California, and I was, you know, really into cars. So I had a lot of old automobile repair manuals from the 60s and 70s, and oftentimes they would have these exploded diagrams of, like, a transmission or an engine, and it would show all the parts sort of flying apart or coming back together, depending on what the way that you were looking at it. And I thought that was a really concise, really visually interesting way to allow the average person to sort of see how these animals come apart from, like, from whole to the multiplicative of cuts, and communicate, like, the process of butchering just a few photographs. And it's also beautiful to boot. The space, however, set against space idea was actually my editor, Judy Prey at Artisan. We were having a meeting about the design of the book, and she was like, and I was explaining this, and she was like, well, it could be against, like, space. And that really tickled our designer, Mike Fusco, and he actually went and downloaded high-resolution images of deep space from the NASA website. So that's actually real space.
I just thought it was rather interesting that there are instructions in there as to how to reassemble a cow.
Yeah.
Just in case you ever needed to do that, you would know.
Yeah.
You would know exactly. Sort of like the thigh bones connected to the hip bone.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff.
You know, that you have, in addition to the photographs and presentations, you have just photographs of food that are yummy and mouth-watering, and then you have whimsical illustrations. And I think that in photographs, you follow a number of your farmer friends, your drinking buddies as well, I gather, as you said,
mm-hmm.
right? And you have little profiles of them. And then you have all these incredible tips, like, who knew, after all these years of cooking, who knew that one way of getting your steak not to leak out all its juice when it was cooked is to rest it in fat?
Yeah.
Did you know about it?
No, it sounds like a good idea. I was looking at the page where the Aflac duck was.
Oh, yeah. Aflac.
I thought it was going to say something to me, but it didn't.
Yeah, no. This is a wonderful book. You were going to tell us more about resting your steaks and fat.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know exactly who first, because it's an idea that traveled by word of mouth throughout kitchens of New York. But as far as I understand it, it's a technique that might have originated at Stone Barns,
okay.
And then was sort of, like, again, traveled by word of mouth to one of my friends who is a chef at River Styx, Homer Murray, and they started experimenting with it. And it's just once you've grilled the steak to just about where you want it, you then just slip it into sort of body temperature. Like just warm fat. It doesn't really matter if it's beef tallow or butter or duck fat. You can kind of use whatever fat you like. Just not olive oil, because that'll just make it taste like olive oil.
Yeah.
And let it rest for about 5 minutes in there. And not only does it keep the steak warm, it also, because of the difference in molecular weight, it doesn't allow any of the juices to come out. And then when you remove it and you slice it, you only get like one or two like tiny drops of blood for the entire steak, which it's a really great tip, really great trick. It's really easy to do. And you can keep the fat, just use it over and over again. It's not like you have to throw it out afterwards. The fat just keeps getting better and better the more you do it.
Yeah, you like fat. You have a whole section on the fat, including schmaltz and whatnot.
Yeah, I think fat is really one of those things.
Yeah, we're coming to that point now, I think, where people finally get the idea that they don't have to avoid all fat.
Well, who was that nice lady who wrote the book about fat?
Yeah, she did Bones, too, and he has a whole section on Bones. Did you know, I can't remember the author now. Do you know those books? One's called Fat, the other one's called Bones.
Yeah, I actually own both of them. They're in the other room, so I don't.
Interviewed that woman. I mean, the books are remarkable. Could I mention that this picture of you, Rabbit, looks like it has boobs?
A witch?
This rabbit picture looks like it has boobs.
Oh, the one floating in space?
Yes.
That's the fucking ears.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the ears.
I don't know if that,
the ears are hanging down where the boobs would be.
It's just getting ready to take off.
I think there's a lot of humor that goes into this book. Your writing in itself is you have really kind of cute asides that bring humor into this whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted the book to be fun because I think that so many books that are about, not like butchering, but about like, you know, ethical meat and all that kind of stuff tends to be very serious and very like liberal guilty. And I don't know. I don't really agree with that way of looking at food. I think food is like one of those things like laughter that like it makes life worth living and food should be fun. It shouldn't be this sort of penance kind of a thing. Yeah. So I try to make it as communicate like my enthusiasm for the subject of food and for the subject of meat and butchering in particular.
As
funny of a way as I can.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do that, and you're somebody I wouldn't mind having dinner with, actually, because I'm sure you'd be fun.
I have this feeling that if you walked into the shop, what's it called again? Let's plug the shop.
The meat hook.
I have a feeling you'd burst out laughing and you wouldn't stop.
it's a good time.
So, I never got to mention, I thought very hilarious is the inside out chicken pot pie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that kind of thing that I just think you do make it a lot of fun. And it's a very worthwhile book. One more plug on that. And everybody should rush out and get it. Tom Mylan, you're a genius. You write as well as cook and also butcher, right? Do you do any art anymore?
No, I don't have enough time right now. I've been thinking about getting back to painting, but I took up surfing instead. So I'm a really bad surfer. That's my hobby right now.
Maybe
once I break something, then I'll get back into painting.
I can't tell you what a relief it is to find out that you're back being a carnivore again with the rest of us and not a vegan. God knows what book you would have written if you were a vegan still.
I hope I would have written a fun book about it. I feel like maybe vegan cookbooks are the ones that really need like the most help with the fun part.
I think they probably do.
Amanda Cohen's book was a riot. It was a comic book.
Yeah. Okay.
Anything we missed you want to say before we sign off, Tom?
Not that I can think of. We seem to have covered a lot of territory.
We do that. Somehow we do that. I'm not sure quite how we managed to do that, but you can take your hook, as they say, and butcher it.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you guys for having me very much.
And we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On The Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
When we first heard about this next product that we're going to talk about, we were somewhat surprised, shall we say. We asked the question, why? And we got a really very good explanation. So if you don't believe you understand pork dust, stick around.
I'm having a great time talking to you, Brett Goodson. You are full of surprises and interesting details. You are the founder of a company called Pork Clouds. But the way I found you was at the Fancy Food Show. They were advertising something called pork dust. Tell us what pork dust is. You created quite a lot of excitement over that at the Fancy Food Show.
Right. Well, pork dust is actually a very simple product, easily described by its name itself. It's actually just conventional pork rinds that have been ground up to serve as breadcrumbs. They're a drop-in replacement to panko breadcrumbs in any recipe, but the beauty is that they don't have any carbs.
Now, are they cooked before they are cooked?
Yeah.
Now, are they really dry? Like, I was wondering if I used the pork dust as breadcrumbs, like as if they were breadcrumbs, would there be added a fat that comes out and kind of juices it up?
I'd say so. Yeah, there is fat. It's about the same fat content as our Pork Clouds product. So basically you're looking at probably about 5 grams of fat per half ounce, so 10 grams of fat per ounce, which is, it's basically enough that if you were to coat a full chicken breast, it would be a similar fat content to a fried chicken breast, but a little less oil, a little less grease.
Would you have to use oil to get it to adhere to the breast if you're coating it?
No, you don't. As long as the chicken breast is pretty moist, you shouldn't need oil. Now, it is a possibility that you may want to mix in other spices. I would recommend mixing in other spices with the pork breast.
Like what?
But you don't actually need to add any oil.
Now, what kinds of foods do you see this being used for?
So we see it on a lot of foods that may be conventionally perceived as southern. So perhaps fried chicken, that's probably the most common use. You take a fresh chicken, roll it in pork dust, and basically you've seasoned it at that point because there's salt in the pork dust and the fat in it, and that kind of completes it on fried chicken. You can use it on fried green tomatoes. You can actually make them more southern than they already were.
That's what I was looking to do. Is we're starting to get green tomatoes in the garden. I was thinking that's what I was going to start with.
I would definitely recommend that. They work extremely well on fried green tomatoes. I actually mixed in cornmeal with the pork dust, and basically that forms kind of a nice gritty / crunchy batter for the fried green tomatoes.
But your main business, or is called Pork Clouds, and that is purely pork rinds, right?
They're a very special interpretation of the pork rinds. So pork clouds are pork skins with the fat melted off. They're cured in salt, and then we fry them in olive oil after that. So basically you exchange pork fat for olive oil, making every calorie valuable and just as tasty, if not quite a bit more tasty than the original.
You're not promoting this as a health food, are you?
I actually purvey it as a semi-health food. It's in between potato chips and kale chips.
Look, could I knock that one up? I mean, I can't deal with kale chips. I can't deal with kale popcorn. I can't deal with anything like that. And it makes everything look so ugly.
Well, what you need is to sprinkle pork dust on your kale.
Yes.
then it'll be fine.
Yeah, wouldn't it be good on mustard greens, huh?
It might. I haven't tried that one.
That'd be good.
Did you try kale?
I haven't tried kale either.
You haven't tried
kale? I've tried kale chips.
What about collard greens?
Collard greens would be great.
I don't think
they're a little more, I guess they're both pretty rugged. But
well, now, Brett, you did something totally different before. You were on a team, product development team, for what do you call the batteries, for hybrid batteries.
Yeah, we worked on hybrid vehicle batteries, part of a product development team doing that, and certainly a bit of a shift, but still a lot of similar focus on quality, and I guess kind of the novelty of the product was actually very similar in both cases.
Well, you know, you're from Georgia, but you don't sound Southern.
Well, that's actually right. I'm actually from Alabama. My parents are Chicago, though, so that definitely changes your perspective a little bit.
Okay. Your website is bacons air.com. What does that mean? Why did you select Bacon's Air?
Well, it's actually kind of two ways of looking at it. I guess it's something of a pun. It's not the original intention, but if you think about it, airy bacon is actually very similar to the pork rind. But the real reason we named it that is basically we're looking at the pork rind as kind of riding the coattails of where bacon has been over the past 10 years. Bacon kind of went from being a food that, you didn't really find that many menus, but now you're finding it in vodka and so many different products, and it's just such a wonderful food that's kind of unfairly maligned. It has its health detriments, but it's certainly very good in other ways.
Do you know the guys at Bacon Freak?
J&D?
J&D Company, J&D
Foods.
I don't think so. Oh, they're the ones that came out with Bacon Salt?
Oh, no, I haven't met them. I met the guy who started Bacon Vodka.
Okay, well, you should get in touch with these guys because they're really over the top. They have a bacon coffin.
They're so far over the top. Their first product was kosher bacon salt. It was bacon salt that contained no bacon whatsoever.
Oh, wow.
Apparently one of them has a father who's a food chemist. So they said, Dad, we had this great, great crazy idea. They said, can you make us something that tastes like bacon, but it's not? I mean, what What a huge market.
Oh, they have everything. Oh, they have a new line of bacon jewelry. Sterling silver.
You might have to work on this because you'd open up a whole new market for yourself with halal and Jewish food. If you could figure out how to get the pig out of the bacon salt.
Well, if I could just change the shape of the hooves on the pigs, maybe I could get somewhere.
That's true. So now tell me what kind of reactions you got at the fancy food show. Were you mobbed?
I was definitely mobbed at various periods during the show. It was a great show for us. We were really happy with how it turned out. Got a lot of interest in really from all of our products. Our pork clouds definitely drew a lot of attention. Our pork dust, we got a lot of interest in working with it, and definitely got a lot of samples out there to chefs that were experimenting with it, some of them who came up with some of the recipes I guess I mentioned, but it was a great show.
Now, you have recipes on your website?
I have a few suggestions on my website, but the Pinterest page definitely has the bulk of the recipes, actually.
Well, you should do a recipe contest. That's what everybody seems to be doing now.
Well, that is a good idea. I think we might actually have to do that. We have had a few chefs design recipes with them, but I like that idea.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody has to be involved. Everything has to be participatory now and social.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
well,
I
now what's the URL to get to the recipes and
How do you get there?
Yeah, so you can actually get to the website for Pork Dust directly with theporkdust.com.
Pork Dust, three
words.
Right, and that's all you need to know. Well,
yeah,
I'm real thrilled that you made a big splash there because I was taken immediately with the thought of it. and I'll let you know if I come up with some ingenious recipe.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of places that it can really really make an impact. I personally like it on the chicken because it makes it so easy to make it. You don't even have to have a fryer or grease or anything, or you could make fried chicken in a 200 square foot apartment.
Well, that's great
with the pork dust. But you know, I've also seen it used in like meatloaf. Well, traditional meatloaf recipes call for so many breadcrumbs that pretty much a bread loaf by the time you're done.
Oh yeah, you could do that. Interesting. Well, the possibilities are endless. So what's next?
Well, I think next we're really trying to get pork dust in the hands of a lot of people who are trying to do things with it. So, for instance, I'm giving it out to chocolatiers who are interested in making basically a pork rind crisp bar. We've actually done it as a promo, and it's really quite delicious. You're embedding a dark chocolate bar with the salt of the pork dust and the crunch of the pork dust and the kind of the slight meatiness of the pork dust as well. And you basically have a crunch bar that tastes a little different. So we're trying to get it in the hands of chocolatiers.
Have you talked to Michael Antinorsi of Churl? Michael Antinorsi, he's a chef. And
okay.
The chocolate company is C-H-A, let's see,
C-H-U-A-O.
Yeah, and he does all kinds of wonderful things like that, and
okay.
He partners with a lot of other people too, producers. So, anyhow, well, good luck to you, and thank you for. I'm looking forward to actually trying the pork dust. I'll let you know.
It will be an experience, I'm sure. But it does drop in just like panko breadcrumbs.
Great.
It can be a replacement.
Okay, so go for it, Brett.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye bye.
I don't know about you, sweetheart, but after all that meat we've been talking about, I feel kind of thirsty.
Right.
That's a hint.
Yeah.
That's a hint because our next program is a very interesting take on the whole subject of beer.
Mirella Amato, I think you know quite a lot about beer, and I want to ask you, first of all, there's one word associated with beer that's in your book that I don't understand in the slightest possible way. And it's a cicerone. What on earth is a cicerone?
Cicerone.
A cicerone is a beer equivalent to a sommelier. So it's really a specialization in the selection, storage, and service of beer. So it deals with the final product, anything from choosing a beer menu for a restaurant based on their food selection and clientele to providing beer descriptions for the menu or for beer labels, suggesting how to pair those beers with food, glassware, serving temperature, that sort of thing. So the Cicerone program comes from the U.S., and there are three levels of certification, and I'm a Master Cicerone, which is the third level.
Now, that's the highest one. Now, where's the derivation of the word come from? It's not to do with the Roman Cicero, is it?
Yes, it is derived from Cicero, and more generally the term is now used to mean guide, a learned guide.
Okay.
It's a Latin word, and in a number of Latin countries they'll use the term Cicerone for tour guides, and in the case of beer, the Cicerones, we help people navigate a beer selection. That's what we do.
And you know a hell of a lot about beer, but here's a tough question for you. You'll probably only know this if you've been there. How long is the leasehold of the Guinness Brewery in Dublin?
That is an interesting question. What's the answer?
The answer is 1,000 years.
Interesting.
Arthur Guinness was a smart guy, and he signed a lease for 1,000 years at some ridiculous rental, like £1 a year, back in the 1870s. And needless to say,
I did go to the Guinness Brewery, but that was years ago.
Okay, well, maybe they just included that more recently. I just thought it was a fun fact.
Did you ever know Michael Jackson, the late Michael Jackson, the beer guy, not the singer?
I am very familiar with his work. Unfortunately, I never had the pleasure to meet him. He died shortly after I started working in beer. And, you know, I have a number of colleagues and friends who knew him well, but unfortunately I never had that privilege.
Yeah, well, he and Peter grew up together.
Here's another piece of trivia. He and I are the same age, and we were born in the same small industrial town in the north of England called Huddersfield. And we never knew each other. Somehow or other, we met him in the middle of a crowded ballroom at the James Beard Awards, and I went up to him and I said, "Aren't you Michael Jackson?" And he said, I don't think he even said, "How do you know?" I think he expected I would recognize him, which is real surprising because I'd never seen a picture of him. I'd never seen him before. And he was a totally fascinating man with a wonderful knowledge, that he just loved to share. And, in a way, you're continuing his work, I think.
In a way, yes. I mean, Michael Jackson really was the first person to draw attention to the wide variety of styles and flavors that were out there, and he's the one who started keeping track of them and creating helpful literature so that people could dive in and enjoy the various styles of beer available. So in that sense, you know, my work is very much a continuation of what he did. This book is really meant for people who want to dive in and explore the beer that's out there. They've noticed the selection. They're not sure where to start. And it's really an invitation to enjoy beer. And I think that's what was behind Michael Jackson's work as well.
You know, it's hard keeping up. There are so many advances in beer. I mean, I knew that last night at this beer match dinner, pairing food and beer, when the first course, the appetizer, came with a beer made with a champagne bacteria or something? What was it?
With a champagne yeast, probably.
Yeast, I'm sorry.
Was it a higher alcohol beer?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and it was.
Yeah, so that's a common technique. Yeah, I think when brewers are trying to reach a higher level of alcohol, some brewers are able to do it using a brewer's yeast, but depending on the yeast character that you want and other variables, sometimes you can ferment the initial stages with a beer yeast, so you can get all the traditional aromas and flavors that you would associate with the beer yeast, and then just finish it off with a champagne yeast to get that higher level of carbonation.
So you get like a secondary fermentation
sort of
thing.
Absolutely.
So they gave us a bottle to take home last night, and it's wide like a champagne bottle.
That's delightful.
Yeah.
That's fun.
And it's going to be unwired in about four hours from now. if it lasts that long. Now you really set about this in a yeoman fashion because you wanted to make sure that everything was in here. Everything's in here in an organized fashion, and it's a collection of things. I'm guessing that you thought people who were interested in beer sort of ought to know.
That's exactly it.
Go ahead.
So I do have those information in there. So, you know, just basics, what is beer, an overview of the different styles that are out there. Because I really think we need to start thinking of beer more in terms of styles and flavors and a little bit less by brand, which is more the tendency.
Oh, that's true.
North America. And beyond that, though, it's also an invitation to have fun with beer. So then the whole second section, diving in,
that urges people to pair beer with food and provides detailed explanations of how to do that, how to throw a quick beer and cheese, a beer and chocolate, a beer dinner, some tasting games, some beer cocktails. I mean, beer can be enjoyed in so many different ways, and I wanted to find, you know, a number of fun ways that beer can contribute to entertaining and to going out in general and spending time with friends, or even, you know, a little game of solitaire here and there. And I think that's what I've added to this book, that's maybe a little less, a little more unusual in the terms of the beginner beer guides that are out there.
Here's a question I've always had. I know that hops adds bitterness to beer, and a hoppy beer like an India Pale Ale is my preference. I like that kind of beer. But who had the idea of first using hops? I mean, it's not really sort of an obvious thing if you think about it, is it?
Well, historically, a number of different herbs were used to bitter beer and to balance some of the richer tones that are found in the malt. Back then, there would have probably been a lot of residual sweetness as well that required something, you know, bitter or sharp to balance it out. And what happened is somewhere along the way, and unfortunately we don't have very clear records, but it was probably somewhere around the 14th century, people who were using hops to bitter their beer noticed that those beers kept better than beers that were hopped with other plants, because hops are a natural preservative. So eventually the word got out. It took a few hundred years, because, you know, they didn't have the internet back then, or even telephones. So it took a while for the word to spread, but people understood that if you brewed beer with hops, it would keep better. It became standard ingredient, and then by the time the German Purity Act was passed, at that point, hops became, you know, a standard beer ingredient. But yeah, it was sort of an evolution, and this is the fascinating thing about beer, is that there is a rich history there, but it wasn't necessarily documented as well as we would like. And so people are constantly researching and finding new tidbits and, you know, things that we thought had first surfaced 1500s that actually been around, you know, for hundreds of years before. And then we find a little mention and everyone starts researching again. It's fascinating because beer is evolving in a forward motion in terms of, you know, the technology and the different ingredients that are being used and the evolution of styles, but it's also evolving in the other sense backwards, in the sense that we're researching back and learning things about the history of beer and about the development of styles that we didn't know before. So it's a really stimulating environment to be working in.
And had a question here.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about how going back and studying beer history. I never understood. Heston Blumenthal had some kind of a research then where he came up with a medieval dish called fried beer. What in the world was that?
Fried beer?
Yeah, I didn't understand that.
She doesn't know either.
One is new to me. There was a company, I think it was 3 years ago, that was literally frying beer.
Why?
They looked like little ravioli. They were frying beer in a little in little pastries, and that won some kind of competition.
I think it was
at a Texas rodeo of some sort, where the different food stands were competing. So I remember that happening, but I suspect that the fried beer you're referring to would have been something entirely different, and I wonder if it was fried at all. Maybe that's a figure of speech. I know that one of the old recipes that I did revive was the lamb's wool.
What's that?
And lamb's wool is a mulled beer that's brewed with apples in it, and as the apples melt, as they cook into the beer, they turn into this white fluff that sort of resembles lamb's wool. So I wonder if fried beer, again, was maybe some sort of expression. Did it not say in the article? Well, now you've got me intrigued.
I'll
have to add that to the list of things I'm looking into. Fried beer.
Yeah.
We discovered something very interesting in an interview two or three years ago with somebody representing Pilsner Urquell. Now, Pilsner Urquell was having some kind of anniversary. I can't remember how many years it was. And the representative of the company explained that until like 1860 or something like that, beer was always cloudy. And he found a way to filter it so that it wouldn't be cloudy anymore, so that it would look much more appealing to people. And not only that, he was the first person to tell us that beer is designed to be poured into a glass. And according to your book, not just any glass either.
Beer definitely, absolutely should be poured into a glass.
So only idiots who don't really like the taste of beer would drink it straight out of a can.
I don't really think it's a question of people being idiots. I think it's a question of a lack of awareness, because what I'm finding is not only are people drinking straight from the bottle or from the can, but what I find more egregious is that establishments are serving beers directly in the bottle or the can. There are many times when I have ordered a beer and someone has just plopped a bottle in front of me and I have to specifically say, excuse me, could I please have a glass to pour my beer into?
Wow.
So if the establishments are just handing people beers in the bottle, how is the consumer supposed to know that that's not the right way to drink it? So this is one of my big crusades right now, is to really spread the word about that, because as any beer specialist will tell you, and as I'm sure the Pilsner Urquell gentleman told you, you can't appreciate the full aromas and flavors of a beer. If it's in a bottle or can, your nose has no access to it. It can't smell
the aromas.
That's right. If you plug your nose, there are only a few basic tastes that you can perceive. But more compelling for me, or I would say maybe not more compelling, but equally compelling for me, is the carbonation issue. Because the brewer is expecting you to pour that beer out. They have designed that beer to be poured out in a glass, and not only for it to be poured out, but for it to be poured out vigorously enough for there to be a head of foam on top of that.
Right,
beer.
That's a big issue.
If you think of any beer ad you've seen, there's always that head of foam on top of the beer.
There's a law about that, isn't it, in England, about it?
There was a revolution in the design of glassware, because somebody complained that draft Guinness is particularly foamy, I guess. So beer aficionados were noticing that they really weren't getting a full glass because there was so much of a collar or a head on top of the beer. And the old joke used to be, you know, wag, bartender, can you fit a double scotch in this beer? And if the bartender says yes, then you say, well, fill it up with beer.
Now, tell me this. How did you get involved with beer? I'm sure there's a story behind this.
Well, I was actually very fortunate in that I was introduced to craft beer and to import beers early on. So essentially, as soon as I started drinking and going out to pubs, the friends I was spending time with at the time were all very much into trying all of these different flavors and styles and exploring these local beers that were around and available to us. I guess it's one of the luxuries of living in a larger city is we had access to those styles even back then. And then I went off to university and found that my friends there were just ordering the same beer over and over again by the pitcher. And it really was beyond me why someone would always drink the same beer when there was such a selection to choose from, right? We don't have the same meal every day, three times a day. We're always varying things. So it became a bit of a crusade for me on a personal level and a bit of a hobby. Always trying to introduce people to new beers if they were resisting the idea of trying something new, trying to find the right beer to introduce them to the idea of switching things up and trying different flavors and driving out to the brewery, which for me was another huge appeal of craft beer, the fact that I could go and see where it's actually made and meet the person who actually made it. So it's always been a hobby for me.
What were you studying in college?
I'm very passionate about. Hmm?
What were you studying in college?
Music.
What kind of music?
I was an opera singer.
Really?
That's a straight line career path. Opera singer to beer expert. Everybody does that.
Norella,
you are really
a curious individual here. Tell us.
Even when I was studying opera, my goal at the time, I always said, when I retire from opera, I'm going to write a book about craft beer. I mean, for me, it was always that impetus to share this passion that I had. It just didn't seem like a realistic career path back then. And I was so fortunate in 2007 when I founded my company, Beerology, and started offering guided tastings and promoting beer appreciation, that it coincided perfectly with a huge renewed interest and huge growth in the industry, and that I've been actually able to turn this into a career. And then I was doubly lucky because around the same time I started, the sister-owned certification program started, and, you know, what I sort of essentially invented as a job for myself, you know, through the certified sister-owned program, actually became a real job and a real title that I could, you know, write an exam for and become qualified to do, which is, you know, very exciting to me because when I started, you know, I had, you know, my passion for beer. And obviously I did a lot of research and I took a lot of courses, but I didn't really have any kind of credentials to back up what I was doing. And, you know, to be able to walk into a room now and say I'm a master cicerone and one of seven people who have achieved this title, it, you know, it immediately inspires trust and people know they can trust my level of expertise in my field. And that feels good.
Now, if I were to say to you Samuel Smith's Imperial Stout, or Samuel Smith's Ale, and then I would say, these are the two beers that I really love the best, and for the longest period of time. What are two that you would pick?
Oh, my goodness, as my favorite beer?
Yeah.
Oh, that's way too difficult. I mean, the number of beers that I sample, I mean, just yesterday I sat down and tasted through a range of the new beers that have been released, and you know, the number of beers I sample in a day, it's really challenging to pick just two. And as I mentioned earlier, my passion for beer really stemmed from the idea that there is a variety.
Okay.
So for me, the passion and the excitement is always finding the perfect beer for any occasion. You know, what is my mood right now? What's the weather like outside? What am I about to eat? Who am I with? What am I wearing? You know, what is the perfect beer for this moment? And, you know, to that end, I have, you know, regularly there will be, you know, 10 to 25 different beers in my fridge, and I have, you know, over 300 in my cellar. So I have many, many styles, you know, within reach at any time so that I can find the perfect beer for any moment.
Well, that's pretty sneaky, Mirella, but I sort of expected that. But the neat part about it is you present so much information in this book.
She even does cocktails, yeah, which is the hottest thing going.
It's almost like you could get to love beer without even tasting any, because all the information is available to you in this really not very large book. And I don't think you left anything out. But listeners, don't forget, when you buy the book, leave yourself enough money to be able to drink some too. Because at the end of the day, that is the objective, is it not? To have a glass that you will enjoy on this occasion, and you'll look forward to that. And if you're not having beer now, you'll look forward to the next time.
So, I've been getting lots of delightful tweets from readers who have a beer in one hand and my book in the other, and they take a little picture and send it to me. It's heartwarming. Yes, I love it.
What's that called? Is it called an alien? It's not a selfie. It's a beer or an alien.
A beer bookie.
Well, anyway, thank you so much for joining us all the way from Toronto, Canada. Keep up the great work, and I'm sure there's another book behind this somewhere.
And just keep
thank you.
Up.
I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
It's called Beerology, and the author is Mirella Amato. Thank you very much for talking to us, Mirella.
Thank you both. It's been fun.
We haven't talked a lot about the Fancy Food Show for some reason, although a lot of these people we met through that exposition for specialty foods. But we ought to mention the fact that our experience with this food show is spread out in a print article in the Tribune Review, and you can come to it by our website, www.onthemenuradio.com. Click on OTM in print.
There you go.
And there you have it.
And we're sure you'll be very interested. And now we had a very interesting time with you, as always. We hope you did with us, too. We hope you'll also join us again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.